Welcome to the post-election day edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're all sort of running on probably too much coffee, certainly in my case, and a little adrenaline left over from last night. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC, is here. Greg, you were out at the Brian Kemp headquarters last night. How are you doing today? You seem wide awake again.
It's a speed. No, I pulled an all-nighter. I couldn't go to bed after that, so I was sitting there updating the blog and writing stories and watching the returns religiously.
Yeah, and you also did, was it last night that you spent a little time with our other panelists today, Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University's Political Science Department? Were you two on MSNBC doing some analysis last night?
About this time yesterday.
Yeah.
Oh, yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, with John Ossoff talking about what we thought would happen.
Okay, and we'll find out in a little while whether you how right you all got it. We're also going to, Tamar Hallerman is on her way here. She, of course, is the Washington reporter for the AJC. She's been in Atlanta covering the campaigns as they unfolded in the last days, so we'll talk to her. But we're also joined by Adam Van Brimmer, who is the editorial page editor of the Savannah Morning News. Adam is in our Savannah Bureau. How are you doing, Adam?
Very good, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Were you up all night, too?
I'm sad to say I was not. I do salute those of you that were, however.
All right. Let's get started. And let's start with the biggest story of this race, Greg. It started to look somewhere around midnight, is by my recollection, you'll tell me if I'm wrong about this, as if Kemp was building up an insurmountable lead. We got to the point where it appeared that if you're the Abrams campaign, you are out there searching, scratching for every precinct you can find that might bring you closer. At one point, Kemp's lead was up to about 200,000 votes.
It was more than 300,000.
Was it 300,000 at one point?
And he had coasted right past Governor Deal's entire vote total around with about a quarter of the precincts left, or maybe it was even more. But no, he looked really good. Of course, Metro Atlanta hadn't really started coming in yet, but that was the big sign of his so-called red wall, the beautiful red wall he was building. He had it right there.
But even when Metro Atlanta came in, Andra, the numbers were not looking strong enough for Stacey Abrams. I mean, we got to a margin of 100+ thousand votes for Kemp at one point, and it never got a whole lot better, and it's still not a whole lot better than that.
So I wasn't thinking about them in terms of absolute numbers of votes. I was looking at percentage point differences. Okay. And so, you know, there was the 8-point difference, and then there was the 3-point difference, and it held at about 3 percentage points for a couple of hours. And, you know, so now we've gotten it to within 2 today as we've started to see absentee ballots being counted.
Yeah.
So, all right. So by the end of the night, it appeared that Brian Kemp was on the verge of being able to declare victory. But the Abrams camp, what happened in that moment, Greg? Was it that the Abrams people wouldn't concede because they are determined that there's still an opportunity for her to push this into a runoff? Did that stop Kemp from giving apparently a victory speech, or are they looking at numbers that worry them it could be a runoff too?
That's where it's really, I think any other candidate other than a Secretary of State would have declared victory. But because Brian Kemp is also overseeing the elections, and if he had gone and said, oh yeah, I'm a winner no matter what, and he had been forced into runoff, because remember, he spoke when it was about 93% precincts reporting. So there's still 7% precincts out. A lot of things could have happened with those 7%. They were confident that they still had to leave, but they weren't, you know, they weren't certain that it would hold. So if he had gone out there and said, yes, I'm the victor, and then got dragged into runoff, she would have, every Democrat would have rightly been able to say, you oversee elections and you couldn't even call your own.
All right. Probably because I'm a little tired, like we all are, I've kind of buried the lead here. So let me go back to it, Adam.
Sure.
Where we stand right now with 100% of the vote counted is Brian Kemp has 50.3.5% of the vote. Abrams has 48.7%.
It's not 100% counted. It's about 99.4%.
Okay, 99.4%.
But that does mean there's a few more precincts coming in.
All right, but the point is that Kemp is maintaining, he's just over the 50% threshold. Adam, this now for the Abrams campaign, who say they're going to battle on for every last absentee vote, every provisional ballot, wherever there might be outstanding ballots, this is no longer an effort to try to get to a victory right. in this stage of the race. She's fighting to live another day, right, Adam?
Yeah, she wants to fight on for the runoff. And, you know, it's probably smart on her part when you think about all those pending ballots that they had, all of the absentee ballots. The fact that a lot of the late arriving, late vote counting happens in counties like Chatham, like Fulton, like DeKalb, that are going to vote Democratic, that it's probably, you know, good to be cautious in if you're Brian Kemp in terms of declaring victory or making any kind of definitive statement.
Tamar Hallerman, by the way, has just joined us. Welcome, Tamar.
I'm sorry. I had to pull over on Georgia 400 to help deal with some breaking news.
What does that mean?
The Democrat in the 6th Congressional District, Lucy McBath, just declared victory over Karen Handel.
Wow. And we're going to get to that, Ray. That's big news, as a matter of fact. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But let's go back to the governor's race. Andra, she wants to get him below 50%. What are you seeing in the numbers that suggest the potential for that to happen?
So this is really all contingent on the number of outstanding absentee ballots and the total number of provisional ballots throughout the state. So, based on these calculations, Kemp is ahead by about 65,000 votes at this particular point. So, with little less than 4 million total votes, right, a 1% margin is going to be less than 40,000 votes, right? So, they've got to find another 25, 30,000 votes in order to force this into a runoff. And so, Greg and Tamar might have better information than I do. How many outstanding absentee ballots are there and how many provisional ballots were cast?
And that's where it gets tricky. Yeah. There's not, from what I understand, especially from the Kemp allies, there's not that many absentee ballots still pending that will be a factor in this race in a major way. It's the provisional ballots, and not just the provisional ballots. And we don't have a firm number on how many provisional ballots are out there, but in 16, a high turnout race, there was about 7,500 or 7,600. So that gives you an idea. There might be higher this year. We're not sure yet. But also, the Abrams campaign says there are the absentee ballots that were held up in the litigation involving the citizenship status. And there's also could be potentially thousands of absentee ballots affected by Hurricane Michael when mail there was routed to Tallahassee. And that could be late as well. And there's a few other things that they're really closely watching. That's why, you know, they might not, even if 100% is reporting and there's no more ballots left, no more, you know, absentee ballots, and even no more provisional ballots, they still might not concede because there's other issues out there.
So, Greg, you and I were both on a phone conference call that the Abrams campaign had this morning, and they made the point that they don't think this is going to end until next week. The counties are required to certify their votes. It should be on Monday. There's some question, is because Monday is Veterans Day, whether or not that will extend to Tuesday. The Abrams campaign says Secretary of State's office has given no clear guidance on that. But essentially, that should bring the whole election to an end. But the Abrams campaign is prepared to fight on with lawsuits, if necessary, beyond that as well.
It could set up a really tricky scenario, too, because, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see a media outlet want to, CNN, AP, whoever, once there's 100% ballots reporting. They might hold off. They might call it. Either way, you could also see Brian Kemp go ahead and declare victory himself because his allies are pressuring him to do so and go ahead and start the administration. Secretary Sonny Perdue came up to me last night in the middle of the evening and said there's no mathematical opening for her whatsoever to win. So Brian Kemp's getting a lot of pressure just to plow ahead forward and, you know, act gubernatorial.
Yeah, Andra. We understand this is certainly no stunt on the part of the Abrams campaign. It probably isn't even, really it isn't even, just sort of a sore loser syndrome. They really believe that they got to get all those votes counted. And I think one of the reasons I would suggest they do is that's been her entire campaign. Mm-hmm. We have to bring new voters to the polls. You are empowered to vote. Let's expand the voter rolls. At this moment, to say, well, never mind, would be a terrible statement of given the reasons that she was trying to expand the roles in the first place.
And I think it would totally disillusion her base.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the new voters that she is excited, but also the warriors who, came into this race not intending to back down from a fight. Right. And so I think if she were to back away from this optically for her, she would lose all credibility. And so I think for that reason alone, like, you know, she's probably gearing up for a fight.
Adam, we have the benefit of having you down there on the coast for us. You talked about outstanding boxes. Where do you see boxes outstanding down your way?
I don't know that we have any clear idea of that at this point. I know that in Pooler, at a church in Pooler, which is at I-95 and the state line in that area near the airport, that there was a precinct that was open and people were still voting at 11 o'clock because of four-hour waits. Mm. The last I had heard from our elections official here, Russell Bridges, was that all the precincts had been counted. But in terms of how many absentee ballots are out, I'm not exactly sure.
We just
sure
don't
about
know.
That. Yeah.
That's another front at which V. Abrams' campaign is suggesting they could move forward and continue to contest the election. Polling places that had too few machines in them, we heard that story over and over again. Especially, we heard it in Metro and in other parts of the state as well, I believe. Technical problems with some of the machines. They're prepared to fight that as far as they can as well.
Yeah, we heard a lot of that in Gwinnett especially, where voters were waiting 2-3 hours. I also heard from somebody volunteering at a poll who was mentioning that the people, not even the voting machines, but the people at the poll who were checking voters in, checking their status, some of these precincts only had one or two people. And then when there were people who, you know, because of the exact match law, weren't quite matching up in the system, you know, that those people had to spend a lot of time looking up their information in line. And so that really backed things up for a long time.
Not to mention the fact this was a long ballot, Andra, and people were taking more time at their stations to get through the entire ballot. So that, too, is a potentially important front for them to wage this ongoing effort to see if they can pull this into a runoff.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's probably going to happen is people have been asked, you know, to come forward if you experienced irregularities, if, you know, there were any difficulties that you've encountered. And so now the Abrams campaign would and their allies would have to sort of compile sort of a list to see if there are any types of systematic patterns that would suggest that there was some type of irregularity that, you know, could be actionable.
So this becomes the ultimate irony, doesn't it, Greg? This is a battle that from the very beginning pitted two people who had very differing views on voter registration and voter participation. Brian Kemp, whose whole effort was, he says, to assure voter security, that people who weren't entitled to vote wouldn't be able to vote. We know that Stacey Abrams battled with him with the New Georgia Project to make sure as many new registrants could come into the system as possible. And here we are on November 7th, and voting issues rise to the surface at this moment.
Who would have thought? And Jim Galloway kind of alluded to this in the blog this morning, in the Political Insider blog. He wrote that a week ago, the Abrams folks had teleconferences with a lot of national reporters and local reporters where they brought up all the myriad issues that could come up. And lo and behold, we're here with a razor-thin margin, you know, Kemp ahead, but a razor-thin margin still, and then bringing up these issues.
Adam, what can you tell us about how your counties, Chatham County down that way, went in terms of the vote? I haven't had a chance to look at your county breakdown at this point.
Chatham County went Democratic, which it normally does.
Right.
But all the surrounding counties went dramatically for Republican. And that's why in a lot of the more local races, whether it was for first congressional district or for some of the state Senate and state rep seats, the Republicans were able to hang on. And I wanted to mention one thing, the exact match situation, I encountered that myself. My last name is Van Brimmer, which is two words, and on my driver's license, it is one word. So when I went to the voting precinct, she couldn't find me initially.
I have a colleague, and the same thing happened to him.
Yeah, and it was interesting because it had never happened. I voted at the same precinct for, you know, probably 8 years now, and it had never happened before, and it was just kind of, they let me vote. It wasn't a big delay, but I can see that the poll workers were obviously told, they were aware of the situation. They were trying to work through the situation, and I can see that causing delays in certain precincts where the lines were very long and the wait was very light, was very long, because I went at a time of day when I could pretty much kind of breeze through.
I think Adam said something important, Andra. He said the exact match wasn't there because of the difference in Van Bremmer stewards in one, but they let him go ahead and vote. This suggests an ability by a poll worker to make a judgment call.
Yeah.
And a judgment call that could be determined in various ways that might be prejudicial to some extent, clearly.
Which is why when Secretary Kemp said weeks ago that, you know, if you're pending because of exact match, you can still show up to vote with your ID, right? That's why a lot of people just didn't trust what he had to say, because even if technically that's the letter of the law, there's always the application of the law and the discretion. I mean, I know that when I've gone to vote, I don't remember how I filled out my voter registration application, but apparently I put my middle name on it. And so when I've actually tried to submit my application on election day and left off my name, people have handed it back to me and told me you need to write your middle name in there. And so, right, that's the discretion. If somebody wanted to, you know, give me a hard time, they might make me jump through more hoops.
All right. Let's look at where the votes came from, Greg. So far, we know that Kemp was spending all of his time, and you were out on the road with him a lot, in rural Georgia. He was looking at the votes in he was looking at the same pattern of votes that President Trump used to win the 2016 election. And yet he outperformed Trump in any number of counties across the rural parts of the state.
Exactly. The red parts of Georgia got redder and the blue parts of Georgia got bluer. The race was closer because he did worse in Metro Atlanta than Donald Trump did, and he did better than Donald Trump did in parts of rural Georgia. And one of the best examples of that is perhaps it's one of the best Trump counties in all of Georgia. It's Banks County, where Trump won that county by about 88% of the vote. Kemp won it by 89% of the vote.
Interesting.
I mean, it's almost impossible to improve on 88, but he got 89. And then you saw that all over rural Georgia, because that was his number one strategy. He was trying to get rural Georgia coming out in big margins, and also trying to find those Trump voters who skipped the midterms before Donald Trump won the presidency and are now energized at the chance to support him.
Andre, how did Stacey Abrams spend a reasonable amount of time in South Georgia? Because although her strategy was to expand the voting base, and certainly among African Americans, among other new voters, younger voters, she too recognized that she had to pick off a certain number of voters from more rural parts of the state, or at least South Georgia around Daugherty County and the like. How did she do with that in terms of getting? Did she, in fact, she didn't seem to be able to energize those voters to make a big, big impact when it came north to Metro?
So just looking overall at the numbers, there were goals. I mean, I think we've talked here on this show. There was a target of trying to get 25% of the white vote. She had 24%.
Yeah.
So she falls short there.
And that's all the difference between a runoff, perhaps, and a Kemp victory or Abrams victory.
And then so the other thing, I mean, the share of the electorate that was African American was greater than it was in 2014. And so, you know, that, is in part the size of the population is growing, but that's also a testament to Abrams' mobilization efforts. I think people were expecting her to do perhaps 95-96% of the African-American vote. The CNN exit poll suggests she got 92%. So that is normal for a Democratic candidate. So that wasn't what was to be expected. One of the things that was actually interesting about that breakdown was that when we break it down by gender, there's a 10-point gender gap amongst African Americans, right? That gender gap amongst blacks was actually bigger than it was amongst whites. And so, you know,
wait, what are you telling us? Say more about that, because I want to understand that. I want to understand what that means, really.
So according to the CNN exit polls, because there are two different sets of exit polls this year, 97% of black women voted for Stacey Abrams. Only 87% of black men voted for Stacey Abrams.
Okay.
That's not dissimilar. There are not quite an apples to apples comparison from, you know, the national number for what African-American men did voted for Donald Trump or voted for Hillary Clinton, I should say, in 2016. But like, we've got to unpack that a little bit more. So there were these differences that on the margins could make a big difference.
I want to find out before we move on. We're going to have to take a break in a minute, and we'll talk about other races in a few minutes. But Adam and Greg, you both have challenges that we don't have in broadcasting. We just keep talking while the election results come in. You have a deadline for the Dead Tree edition of your paper. Adam, you all have deadlines for the Dead Tree edition of your paper. Sure. Adam, what was the front page headline about this race when people woke up and got the Savannah Morning News?
Too close to call.
It was too close to call.
Too close to call.
And what time did that go to bed?
I think it went at 12:30, I want to say, because our paper right now is designed in Texas. So we have a little bit earlier deadlines than what we would have back in the day when we were done all locally. So it was, it was too close to call.
And Greg, you all had a couple of editions. What are you seeing? Andre Gillespie just showed you something.
We have now officially 100% of those precincts reporting. And it looks like the numbers are largely unchanged. Abrams has a 65,000 vote deficit to Kemp, who is still at 50.35. Percent of the vote, which is enough to avoid a runoff. It still might not mean that Abrams certainly signaled that she will not concede the race, but you might see other media outlets now might want to endorse or might consider not endorsing, but calling the race now that 100% are in. But who knows? I've been in part of those discussions at my old job, but I don't know how.
When you were at the Associated Press.
You got it.
Yeah. What was your final? What was your headline in the final
edition?
So
it's fun for us because I usually have four different versions of the story. I had a too close to call, a runoff, an Abrams win, a Kemp win. And I email them all to myself to keep them for keepsakes, to look back at. And we also have different analyses for this is why Abrams won. This is why Kemp won. We ended up going, we had four different deadlines too. We had a 2:30 a.m. deadline was the last one, which was a rarity. But we ended up going with something like Kemp leads, right?
Yeah.
And then we went with the too close to call. Election day drama continues.
All right. Before we get to a break and before we move into some of these incredible congressional races that we're watching unfold, what do we think? I mean, Andra, is it close to time to call this race for Kemp now that we have these numbers that say we're at 100%?
I would expect the national media outlets to call it for him. And then I think the next question will be, well, what next does Abrams challenge?
Okay, let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, I want to talk a little more about numbers in the governor's race in the metro area, especially as they may have driven people to the polls in two big congressional races. We'll do that after this.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Ooh, drive away. Ooh, drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Senior producer Tom Faust has just served Dr. Andre Gillespie and Greg Bluestein. It looks like cappuccino? Is that what you're drinking there?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm drinking a mocha.
Made by On Second Thought host Virginia Prescott, who came in this morning to thank everyone for their hard work last night, hauling her espresso machine, a bean grinder, and a beautiful set of espresso cups and saucers. It was very lovely of Virginia. All right.
I'm flying up next time, guys.
Yeah, Adam, we definitely should be up here for this. Okay, so let's talk a little about the governor's race and use it as a transition into what you just told us about Lucy McBath declaring victory in the 6th District. So one of the things that did happen last night is that we can now officially say that Cobb and Gwinnett have turned blue, at least for the time being, right? I mean, Abrams clobbered Kemp in both Cobb. He by 10 points in one, and I think by 12 points or something in the other.
Last night it was 14. I don't know what the final
number is. Okay, maybe more, right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was double digits.
It's 14 in Gwinnett.
It's those counties are now blue. They turned purple when they went for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Now they're blue.
Yeah, for now anyway. 2016 was not a blip.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that was the first time in generations that either county had voted for a Democrat.
In 16 it was.
In 16. So that's a pretty amazing figure. I had not heard 14 points. That's okay. Amazing.
So, with that in mind, you tell us that you've just pulled off the road to write a quick piece on the fact that Lucy McBath had declared victory in the 6th District, the Democratic challenger to Karen Handel. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, as far, or at least when I was writing this story at 1:45, no major news outlet had called the race yet. So we had not heard anything from the AP. They're, you know, based on the Secretary of State's website, which I have right in front of me, you know, we're still technically in recount territory. I have McBath at 50.45% and I have Handel at 49.55%. So Handel could call, you know, ask for a recount. So it might not be over yet, but still, this is pretty darn amazing. I mean, last year, this district was the site of the most expensive contested congressional race in the country. Some $60 million was spent between Handel's and John Ossoff's allies. So it's pretty darn amazing that you know, as the nation's spotlight had shifted elsewhere, there were a million other races going on. That really helped Lucy McBath come in there and potentially knock off Handel.
Yeah, you know, Adam, it's interesting. Stacey Abrams may end up having to concede at some point in the days ahead, but she probably can take credit for helping drive up Democratic voters in that 6th district race. And if it's any small consolation, she may have put one more Democratic member in the new Congress, Adam.
Absolutely. It's amazing the swing that we saw on the House side, especially when you can contrast it with the fact that we did not see a similar swing in the Senate. Actually, we saw the Republicans gain ground over there. But Stacey Abrams has energized her base. I will be interested to see when the Secretary of State site updates their demographic information to compare the numbers of African-American voters 4 years ago or even 2 years ago to what we had today to see exactly how much her grassroots efforts over the last 5 to 10 years. And she had people on the ground here in Savannah in Chatham County canvassing and doing things as well. It'll be interesting to see the difference there.
And let me echo that. Not just Lucy, her coattails did not just include Lucy McBath, but also about a dozen state legislative flips, mostly through the suburban metro Atlanta, like areas like the 6th District and the 7th District. And maybe perhaps thanks to Stacey Abrams, Woodall, Congressman Woodall, has one of the biggest targets on his back in 2020 because that race was about a point. You know, it still hasn't been called yet, but he's only up by about a point in that race that he won comfortably 2 years ago.
Faust just told me that it's now a 900 vote margin that Woodall has Carolyn Bordeaux.
And Rob Woodall, I've been talking to him about this race for months, and his camp has been so just cool as a cucumber this whole time. They had internal polls that showed him up by 27 points as recently as a month ago, and they were always saying, nobody gets this district like we do. People know us. We don't have anything to worry about. So this is certainly a disappointment for them. They still, you know, are kind of holding their breath to see what happens. Bordeaux's people have indicated that they're really hoping a recount will get them there.
We can always tell that when a Republican's in trouble when his or her colleagues start calling us and venting about them. And that's exactly what happened. We started hearing about a week ago. All these people saying how mad they were that Woodall wasn't going on air, or that Woodall wasn't accepting Trump support, or that Woodall didn't go to Macon to be with the president, or, you know, whatever it might be, or Woodall wasn't campaigning enough. And it, you know, it might turn out that he's okay, even though, you know, he didn't do all those things. But certainly there's a lot of a second guessing, especially about his TV strategy.
Yeah, you know, go ahead.
Well, it's just so interesting. You know, both of these races are kind of hanging on by a thread for these incumbents. Handel treated McBath like she was John Ossoff. She was, you know, fighting her tooth and nail pretty much from the beginning. Woodall took an entirely different strategy, super low key, kind of ignored Bordeaux for as long as he could, didn't go up on TV until 4 days before the election, didn't tweet, barely did any media. They really wanted to kind of go under the radar there. So neither strategy really worked when, you know, not only is there so much energy on the Democratic side, but you have somebody like Stacey Abrams who is pretty long coattails, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that if Woodall does end up the declared winner in that race, he's got the voters of Forsyth County to thank for that, because that's a Republican stronghold within the district, right?
Yes, but I pulled up the numbers between, you know, how he did in 2016 and how he's doing as of this morning. And yes, in Forsyth, he's getting something like, here it is, 68% of the vote. But 2 years ago, he got 78% of the vote. Same margin in Gwinnett. He got about 45% of the vote yesterday, but last year he got 55.
Oh my gosh! If Forsyth County is turning purple, can the rest of the state
not
be
purple,
far
but maybe slightly less red?
Yeah, no, I get it, Andre. You know, it's interesting that Greg talks about down ballot races and how we've seen in Metro things change. I was looking at the races in Gwinnett County as an example of that. We've already said that Abrams beat Kemp by 14 points in Gwinnett County. But Senate District 40, a stronghold for Fran Millar. I mean, Fran has been a fixture in the Georgia General Assembly for, I don't know,
years
and years and years. A Republican, of course. And he is now giving that seat up to Democrat Sally Harrell. That in itself is interesting.
And that's in neighboring DeKalb County, but that shows you, and I think he has
That's right. Of course it's DeKalb.
But that's important, too, because now DeKalb County's entire delegation, which is a huge delegation,
is now Democratic.
All Democratic, because not only did Senator Miller lose, but also Megan Hansen lost to a very strong challenge. And Mike Walensky, who's a neighbor of mine, coincidentally, won the open seat held by Republican Tom Taylor.
Okay, thank you for straightening out my geography. I told you I was tired. But we do have Senate District 48, which is in Gwinnett County, you know, and that was a David Schaefer seat. Mm-hmm. David was the president pro tem of the Senate. Again, a longtime member of the state Senate, a Republican, ran for lieutenant governor and lost in the primary there. He lost to a Democrat, Zara Karinchak. And that's interesting from an ethnic point of view. And if you go down the ballot a little bit more, Andra, that for the first time in more than 30 years, there are two Democrats who've been elected to serve on the Gwinnett County Commission. One is the grandson of Chinese immigrants who is openly gay, the first gay member. And the other is an African-American Democrat, Marlene Fosk. It's astonishing the way the diversity of Gwinnett is finally being felt at the polls.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there had, you know, been discussions about whether or not district lines had been drawn in such a way that would actually make it adverse to people of color actually being able to elect candidates of their choice. And you still need to interrogate, you know, those mechanisms and whether or not that can actually stifle descriptive representation. On the other hand, though, sometimes it's just a matter of waiting. And eventually the demographics are going to catch up with the politics. And so people should have been paying attention. And if they haven't been paying attention, now it's happening. I mean, I think there are important things to think about, sort of this idea that, for instance, all African Americans live in inner cities, which was never true in the first place, is especially not true now. Or the idea that immigrant groups will settle in ethnic enclaves in cities is also not true. There's a lot of evidence that suggests that the first place they go is suburbs, which means that suburban politics is now ground zero for you know, questions of diversity and descriptive representation, and it's manifesting itself in Gwinnett County, not just this year, but I mean even last year when we think about the municipal elections. So the idea that Lawrenceville and Norcross have mayors of color, it was also a harbinger of what we see happening today and what's likely going to continue to happen for the near future.
Adam, what are some of the races down there that really struck you that we should talk about for the next few minutes?
Sure. There was one. Let's start with the first congressional district with Buddy Carter. You mentioned Rob Woodall and the difference between the candidate approaches. Well, Buddy, in large part, mirrored that approach. He, for lack of a better term, he ducked forums with Lisa Ring, his opponent, for some time. His office will say it was a scheduling thing and this and that and the other. But one, he didn't get the forum scheduled until late. And then another one, he didn't show up. He said there was some miscommunication. He ended up doing that forum later. But basically, he wanted to try, or it appeared that he was, basically, he's in a Republican district. He feels very comfortable. He wasn't going to engage her and give her credibility. Well, when he does engage her, the forum, he struggles at the forum. So there was a lot of curiosity down here as to how that will be reflected in the vote. Well, when he won his House seat in 2014, he won 60-40. Last night, he won 59-41. So some of that is probably the nature of his opponent. She was very much, she was a liberal, progressive liberal who talked a lot about the national issues and not so much about the local issues, which is Buddy is very, very strong on that, especially when it comes to the ports, especially when it comes to the economy. So obviously his message, while people may have been dissatisfied with him, and certainly here in Savannah, he's heard a lot of backlash and taken a lot of grief over it. It didn't seem to translate yesterday.
Adam, let me ask you this. I did a story about the different scenarios that could have unfolded, and I was told if there was a big, you know, epic blue wave, that Ron Stevens, yeah, a longtime state representative down there, would be in trouble. How close did he come to having any real threat?
Very close. It was less than 1,000 votes.
Wow. You
know, it was surprisingly tight. Ron Stevens, of course, has been in the state house since, I think I was in
forever,
high school, since early 90s. And he faced a challenger, Alicia Scott, who is a military wife who has lived in this area for less than 10 years. And she was part of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2016, and she ran a very strong ground game. And that was another thing that Lisa Ring, who faced Buddy Carter, she was out and about and pressing the flesh and talking to the people, and people we thought would respond to it. Well, when it comes to Alicia Scott, I think they did respond to it. So the thing about Ron Stevens is you're talking about somebody who's incredibly influential in the state house. Mm-hmm. He leads the Economic Development Committee. He sits on the Rules Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, the Appropriations Committee. The one wild card when it comes to Ron Stevens, though, is the fact that he is the driving force in this state behind legalizing casino gambling. So how much of that with the people in his district rubbed them the wrong way, I'm not sure. The district to me would not appear to be a uber conservative district, but maybe there was some backlash in terms of casino gambling.
What kind of footprint does Buddy Carter have on the Hill tomorrow?
Well, he's still a junior lawmaker,
yeah,
so I wouldn't overstate it. But at the same time, I would say he's one of the more ambitious lawmakers in our delegation. So he's really been moving up really fast. He campaigned really hard to get on this really powerful committee that oversees healthcare and energy, manufacturing, trade. And so that has given him a really good position to look out for a lot of state issues like the port, like Plant Vogel in Augusta. So he's really been one to watch in that respect.
Prescription drugs as well.
Exactly.
He's a pharmacist, and
he's only
been a big
pharmacist.
Push for that.
You know, it's funny that the fact that he didn't show up at forums has become an issue, because I remember during the town hall debates, he had, you know, multiple times. There was one,
yes,
string where he had like 10 town halls.
He's like
in
the
3 days.
One of the, yeah, only lawmakers in our delegation to hold town halls, and he kept talking about how that was so important. So,
so he certainly never ducked the crowd. That's funny.
So, Andra, I'm curious about something. We could see, we do think maybe Lucy McBath flips the seat. It's interesting. Last night, NBC News at one point called the 7th. Or Kelvin,
oh, yeah,
they had to take it back.
Which they,
yeah,
had to take back. The Bordeaux people contacted all of us and said, no, we don't think that's really happened here yet. It's possible that she could win that seat, although the numbers don't look to be too well and too much in her favor. Do we, as we move forward, do we see other congressional seats held by Republicans in this state that really are in any kind of jeopardy? I, for instance, let's look at 2020, because in 2021, Republicans with Brian Kemp, if he's the governor, will continue to gerrymander the state in their favor, as Democrats would do if they'd won the state house or the governor's mansion too. But are there any other congressional seats that we should be looking at as possible flips in the next 2 years?
So I'm going to assume that at best between the 6th and the 7th, one of those districts flips.
Right.
Right. So, you know, so clearly whichever district doesn't flip is going to be the first prime target. Beyond that, you know, I know people were interested in running in the 11th. I think you have to think about, about that as a potential target. So,
and that's Barry Loudermilk's district up in the exurbs in, what is that? Like Northern Cobb County, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Kennesaw.
Right.
Art.
I mean, so it's the same sort of suburban expansion. And so the footprint of, you know, what used to be considered exurban Atlanta is actually now becoming more like suburban Atlanta. And the demographics might start to encroach.
Yeah, except
Loudermilk
won, but with 62% of the vote.
Right. But I'm just saying, I've had people approach me and, like, you know, ask me, what do you think about that particular district? Right. And it's because it's part of Metro metro Atlanta. So I think that people would think about that.
Tamara, are there any other seats out there that by 2020 could be looking more Democratic? It doesn't seem likely,
no.
Does it?
No. I was intrigued by Rick Allen's Augusta district. He did fine yesterday. Actually, the one that I think is the closest to flipping the other way could be Sanford Bishop's yes.
right.
district
yeah. right.
in Southwest Georgia.
Here's a Democrat who has held on for two decades
right. yes.
in a red district.
Heavily rural, very agricultural. It also has Albany and Columbus, but he's done a pretty good job. You know, he's a blue dog Democrat. On a lot of economic national defense issues, he's voting with Republicans, and he's kind of found the way to thread that needle there. So maybe when Sanford Bishop is ready to retire, or with Trump on the ballot again in 2020, that could change that calculus.
I sort of have always thought that Sanford Bishop is a remarkable politician, number one. And number two, if you want to think about the possibility that there's hope for us to all get along, he's held that seat as an African-American congressman with these rural white mm-hmm. farmers all around him. And they usually say great. They love him.
And he won 60-40 yesterday.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that was interesting was that early on when the early numbers started to come in, like that margin was much more narrow. And so, you know, I was flipping through and looking at it. I went, I didn't expect to see that. And then, you know, we saw the race kind of converge on what I would call its equilibrium. But at first, it wasn't 100% clear that that was what was going to happen. And, you know, his candidate, a guy named Herman West, is an African-American Republican. So, you know, I'm sure that when Republicans are thinking about ways to diversify their party, they, you know, were thinking that might actually be sort of a prime matchup.
Yeah.
I can see that district as whoever gets to be in control of redistricting, somebody's going to want to chop that up a little bit more and try and flip that one way or another.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting right now. Tamara, I got to break in. Tom Faust is whispering in my ear. In fact, it's a loud whisper. Jeff Sessions, according to the New York Times, has just resigned as Attorney General at President Trump's request, according to the New York Times. Andre just shrugged like, so?
The post-midterm shakeup.
He didn't wait long.
He
didn't
promised.
Wait long. All right. Well, there'll be plenty more of that on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock this afternoon and throughout the news cycle. But, Adam, let me go back to this notion of flipping districts. I overlooked the most basic one. Buddy Carter did win with 58% of the vote, but is there a Democrat down that way who might have a potential opportunity to come in there who maybe can outdo Lisa Ring in that race down there? Or does this kind of make it clear that Buddy Carter's safe for the time being?
Monday, I would have told you that, yeah, there's a possibility 2 years down the road, especially if Buddy Carter continues to have such a full embrace of President Trump and the dissatisfaction with President Trump continues to grow. But after seeing him win 59% yesterday, I really think it's going to be difficult because of the size and the shape of the district. I mean, the district basically makes a reverse L. It goes all the way down the Georgia coast and then goes inland. So, yes, Savannah, Chatham County can be pretty Democratic, but the rest of the district is very red. And I don't see that shifting in 2 years unless there's a tremendous backlash against President Trump, if the economy goes in a tank or what have you. I'd say Buddy's safe.
Adam, what I'm interested in your neck of the woods, too, is you just mentioned it. Savannah's a pretty Democratic stronghold, but yet you have a Republican mayor.
That's right.
How's he doing?
He's hanging in there. You know, it's been kind of rough. He came in promising to clean up crime, and he did that. So that has been a very positive sign for Mayor Eddie DeLoach. Of course, he'll be up for re-election next year. We're not exactly sure who from those are nonpartisan races, obviously, but Eddie DeLoach is a Republican. So who is going to rise up to challenge him, probably from a more Democratic side? We're not sure.
All right, Adam, I got to interrupt you because Tom Faust has given me the sign that if I don't get to a break right away, he's going to come in here and throw me out of the studio. We're on Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, how U.S. law enforcement failed to see the threat of white nationalism and now doesn't know how to stop it. We talk with Janet Reitman about her article in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. She reports that domestic counterterrorism strategy has focused on Islamic extremists and ignored the rising danger of far-right extremists. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and streaming live at gpbnews.org.
We had a Facebook Live question. We know that we're going to see, Greg, a runoff now in the Secretary of State's race. John Barrow, the Democrat, against Brad Raffensperger. The question on Facebook Live was whether or not a Democratic Secretary of State would be more likely to try to work to change the a statute, to create a statute which would say a Secretary of State has to step down if she or he is running for office. I think Democrats would be as unlikely to want to do that as Republicans would.
And candidates from both parties have, as we've seen, you know, we've written about this before, have not stepped down while running for higher office, and some have. Karen Handel did. Kathy Cox didn't. But, of course, Kathy Cox never made it as far as Brian Kemp did as the general election nominee. But it's interesting. I mean, the Secretary of State doesn't have any formal role in legislating, but he or she can use the bully pulpit to encourage that.
Well, he asked John Barrow that question when he was in visiting with us, and he said that if he was in the situation that Brian Kemp is now, that he would at least recuse himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about this case is the fact that the Public Service Commission race of Lindy Miller is going to go to a runoff, and that the Secretary of State's race is going to go to a runoff. I think it shows that Georgia is moving from red to perhaps pink now, and perhaps moving towards purple. And so, you know, it was not just a fluke that the gubernatorial race is this low. Like, there's some down ballot races that are also important.
And I think you also said an important thing about that. We have said on this show any number of times that maybe the blue wave doesn't start at the top of the ticket. It starts in those down ballot races, the PSC, the Secretary of State, the Insurance Commissioner. Yeah,
right. And so, and I think in particular with the Secretary of State's race, given all of the attention that has been given towards voting rights and voter suppression, right, this becomes a marquee race. And so regardless of what happens with the gubernatorial race, from a strategic standpoint, the Democrats would be wasting an opportunity to not put every resource behind John Barrow and making voting rights a front and center issue to talk about balance and to talk about sort of who do you want in charge of your election process.
I hope it becomes a high profile race that voters pay attention to from both sides of the party line. But I think it's going to be really hard in December to get voters' attention back without someone like Stacey Abrams or Brian Kemp on top of the ticket, especially when you go further down the ballot to public service commissioner.
And Bill, I think I would challenge the premise completely, because John Barrow is a moderate. He is a Democrat, but he's a very moderate Democrat. And then when it comes
he's a Democrat, but he doesn't bite.
He doesn't bite, right? And then the PSC races. The one thing with the PSC races is I was kind of surprised we didn't see more crossover support, just because people want to see more voices on that commission, a commission that has five Republicans currently, a commission that is dealing with Plant Vogel and Georgia Power. At least in this area, there was a lot of talk about should we vote Democrat just to try to add some balance to that. So I don't know how much partisanship plays into those two races.
Okay, we're running a little short of time, but I want to ask one more question that I'd love to hear everybody weigh in on. In 2014, Jason Carter lost the governor's mansion by
8 points.
He ran as essentially a yellow dog Democrat. He was a conservative Democrat. He didn't want to get out there and take progressive stands on the issues. One of the things that was so fascinating about this race is that Stacey Abrams said from the start, she didn't say it, but she adopted progressive positions on crucial issues and did it without any hesitation. And so she set up for us a great contrast between a very conservative Republican and a progressive Democrat. Carter loses by 8. Maybe Abrams, if she loses by a hair's breadth.
A point and a half.
It suggests that even if her strategy didn't put her over the top, she may be onto something that other Democrats in this state are going to have to look at. That's one theory. Maybe not. What do you all think?
I'll take a quick crack at first. What Jason Carter would probably tell you, too, though, is that, hey, he centered his campaign on Medicaid expansion as well. And so did she. I mean, that was her opening and closing argument. Also, the political environment has changed drastically in the last 4 years. Donald Trump has changed things up. And Georgia's demographics have changed a little, not as drastically, but they've also changed. And we've seen a wave of women run for office and win office and get significant resources behind them that they didn't maybe have even 4 or 6 years ago. to run for state office.
Okay, so my hypothesis you would take issue with to begin with. Yeah.
I mean, I think that there certainly is something about presenting oneself as a moderate versus presenting something as being more left of center. And Abrams is definitely more left of center, but she's also more credibly bipartisan. And yes. So sometimes I'm like, she gets called progressive because she's a black woman. And so people make assumptions about her race and gender that I think people need to be careful. But I mean, she's definitely presented herself as more liberal than Jason Carter. So
she
I'm not
calls
just
herself unapologetically.
Yeah. So I'm not. Yeah. So I'm not challenging that. I'm also not challenging the times. I think the bigger issue here is the idea that in order to be viable as a statewide candidate, as a Democrat in the state, you basically have to be embodied as a conservative white Democrat. I think she has blown that one out of the water.
Okay, thank you. Then that does kind of, that's kind of where I was headed with that. Adam, what's the lesson you take out of this election? We got about, each of you, you and Tamar, get about 30 seconds or so to give us your answer.
At the state level, I think it's that the politicization that we're seeing nationally is trickling down to the national, and it's the future of this is get as much of your base out as you can and run on your principles or your ideology and let the chips fall where they may.
I think that transfers down to the congressional races as well, whereas you saw people like John Ossoff trying to run a little more toward the middle. You're now seeing people who've been winning or getting closer to winning being more unapologetically progressive, as Abrams would call it.
All right. By the way, Tamar, if I were you, this is the moment I would go to Kevin Riley and ask for a raise.
Seriously.
Because after January, when you have a Democratic majority House and a Republican-controlled Senate, you're not going to get a minute's rest, and you're going to be asked to do four stories a day.
I'm excited. Let's do it.
It's going to be fascinating. And as we get closer and closer to January, we'll talk a lot on this show about what to expect from our divided Congress in the year or so ahead. So that's about it for us. We're kind of wrapping up our election coverage on Political Rewind. I'm so grateful to all of you who started with us on TV at 7 o'clock last night, followed us over to radio where we started at 8 o'clock, didn't sign off until after 2. And I can't tell you how many notes I've gotten from people out there who've said that you appreciate the fact we were here. And that just makes us all feel so grateful that you think that we're doing the kind of job that you care about. So thank you for your feedback. Thanks for being with us throughout the election. We'll be back, of course, with the show on Friday. Teresa Tomlinson, Rusty Paul, Stacey Evans, a really powerful lineup for our combined radio and TV show. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nygut. We're going to all go. Are you ready to get some rest?
Oh, yeah.
Bluestein, about you?
I have to go teach later.
Oh, my gosh.
I haven't had coffee yet.
All right. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Thanks
from Savannah. It was great to have you with us. Take care, everybody. We'll see you on Friday.